Osho, a sudden clash of thunder. Talks on Zen stories. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 4.
The first question. I believed I was uncreative. What else can be creativity besides dancing and painting? And how to find out what is my creativity? Creativity has nothing to do with any activity in particular, with painting, poetry, dancing, singing. It has nothing to do with anything in particular. Anything can be creative. You bring that quality to the activity. Activity itself is neither creative nor uncreative. You can paint in an uncreative way. You can sing in an uncreative way. You can clean the floor in a creative way. You can cook in a creative way. Creativity is the quality that you bring to the activity you are doing. It is an attitude, an inner approach, how you look at things. So the first thing to be remembered, don't confine creativity to anything in particular. A man is creative. And if he is a creator, whatsoever he does, even if he walks, you can see in his walking, there is creativity. Even if he sits silently and does nothing, even non-doing will be a creative act. Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, doing nothing, is the greatest creator the world has ever known. Once you understand it, that it is you, the person, who is creative or uncreative, then this problem disappears. Everybody cannot be a painter. And there is no need also. If everybody is a painter, the world will be very ugly. It will be difficult to live. And everybody cannot be a dancer, and there is no need. But everybody can be creative. Whatsoever you do, if you do it joyfully, if you do it lovingly, if your act of doing it is not purely economical, then it is creative. If you have something growing out of it within you, if it gives you growth, it is spiritual, it is creative, it is divine. You become more divine as you become more creative. All the religions of the world have said God is the creator. I don't know whether he is the creator or not, but one thing I know, the more creative you become, the more godly you become. When your creativity comes to a climax, when your whole life becomes creative, you live in God. So he must be the creator, because people who have been creative have been closest to him. Love what you do. Be meditative while you are doing it. Whatsoever it is, irrelevant of the fact what it is. Have you seen Paras cleaning this floor of Chuang Tzu auditorium? Then you will know cleaning can become creative. With what love? Almost singing and dancing inside. With such love, if you clean the floor, you have done an invisible painting. You lived that moment in such delight that it has given you some inner growth. You cannot be the same after a creative act. Creativity means a loving. Whatsoever you do, enjoying, celebrating it as a God's gift. Maybe nobody comes to know about it. Who is going to praise Paras for cleaning this floor? History will not take any account. Newspapers will not publish her name and pictures. But that is irrelevant. She enjoyed it. The value is intrinsic. So if you are looking for fame and then you think you are creative, if you become famous like Picasso, then you are creative, then you will miss. Then you are in fact not creative at all. You are a politician, ambitious. If fame happens, good. If it doesn't happen, good. It should not be the consideration. The consideration should be that you are enjoying whatsoever you are doing. It is your love affair. Your act is your love affair, then it becomes creative. Small things become great by the touch of love and delight. The questioner asked, I believed I was uncreative. If you believe in that way, you will become uncreative. Because belief is not just belief. It opens doors, it closes doors. If you have a wrong belief, then that will hang around you as a closed door. If you believe that you are uncreative, you will become uncreative. Because that belief will obstruct, continuously negate all possibilities of flowing. It will not allow your energy to flow because continuously you will say, I am uncreative. This has been taught to everybody. Very few people are accepted as creative. Few painters, few poets, one in a million. This is foolish. Every human being is a born creator. What children, and you will see, all children are creative. By and by, we destroy their creativity. By and by, we force wrong beliefs on them. By and by, we distract them. By and by, we make them more and more economical and political and ambitious. When ambition enters, creativity disappears. Because an ambitious man cannot be creative. Because an ambitious man cannot love any activity for its own sake. While he is painting, he is looking ahead. He is thinking when he is going to get a Nobel Prize. When he is writing a novel, he is looking ahead. He is always in the future, and a creative person is always in the present. We destroy creativity. Nobody is born uncreative, but we make 99% people uncreative. But just throwing the responsibility on the society is not going to help. you have to take your life in your own hands. You have to drop wrong conditionings. You have to drop wrong hypnotic auto-suggestions that has been given to you in your childhood. Drop them. Purify yourself of all conditionings, and suddenly you will see you are creative. To be and to be creative are synonymous. It is impossible to be and not to be creative. But that impossible has happened. That ugly phenomenon has happened. Because all your creative sources have been plugged, blocked, destroyed. And your whole energy has been forced into some activity that the society thinks is going to pay. Our whole attitude about life is money-oriented. And money is one of the most uncreative things one can become interested in. Our whole approach is power-oriented, and power is destructive, not creative. A man who is after money will become destructive, because money has to be robbed, exploited. It has to be taken away from many people, only then you can have it. Power simply means you have to make many people important. You have to destroy them, only then you will be powerful. You can be powerful. Remember, these are destructive acts. A creative act enhances the beauty of the world. It gives something to the world. It never takes anything from it. A creative person comes into the world, enhances the beauty of the world. A song here, a painting there. He makes the world to dance better, to enjoy better, to love better, to meditate better. When he leaves this world, he leaves a better world behind him. Nobody may know him, nobody may not know him. That is not the point. But he leaves the world a better world. Tremendously fulfilled that his life has been of some intrinsic value. Money, power, prestige are uncreative, not only uncreative, but destructive activities. Beware of them. And if you are beware of them, you can become creative very easily. I am not saying that your creativity is going to give you power, prestige, money. No, I cannot promise you any rose gardens. It may give you trouble. It may force you to live a poor man's life. All that I can promise you is that deep inside you will be the richest man possible. Deep inside you will be fulfilled. Deep inside you will be full of joy and celebration. You will be continuously receiving more and more blessings from God. Your life will be a life of benediction. But it is possible outwardly you may not be famous, you may not have money, you may not succeed in the so-called world. But to succeed in this so-called world is to fail deeply. Is to fail in the inside world. And what you are going to do with the whole world at your feet if you have lost your own self? What you will do if you possess the whole world and you don't possess yourself? A creative person possesses his own being. He is a master. That's why In the East, we have been calling sannyasins swamis. Swami means a master. Beggars have been called swamis, masters. Emperors we have known, but they proved in the final account, in the final conclusion of their life, that they were beggars. A man who is after money and power and prestige is a beggar, because he continuously begs. He has nothing to give to the world. Be a giver. Share whatsoever you can. And remember, I am not making any distinction between small things and great things. If you can smile wholeheartedly, hold somebody's hand and smile. And it is a creative act, a great creative act. Just embrace somebody to your heart and you are creative. Just look with loving eyes at somebody. Just a loving look can change the whole world of a person. Be creative. Don't be worried what you are doing. One has to do many things, but do everything creatively, with devotion. Then your work becomes worship. Then whatsoever you do is a prayer. And whatsoever you do is an offering at the altar. Drop this belief that you are uncreative. I know how this belief is created. You may not have been a gold medalist in the university. You may not have been the top in your class. Your painting may not have won appreciation. When you play on your flute, neighbors report to the police, maybe. But just because of these things, don't get the wrong belief that you are uncreative. That may be because you are imitating others. People have a very limited idea of being creative. Play the guitar or the flute or write a poetry. So people go on writing rubbish in the name of poetry. You have to find what you can do and what you cannot do. Everybody cannot do everything. You have to find and search your destiny. You have to grope in dark, I know. It is not very clear cut. What is your destiny? But that's how life is, and it is good that one has to search for it. In the very search, something grows. If God was to give to you, when you were entering into the world, a chart of your life, this will be your life. You are going to become a guitarist. Then your life will be mechanical. Only a machine can be predicted, not a man. Man is unpredictable. Man is always an opening. Potentiality for 1001 things. Many doors open and many alternatives are always present on each step. And you have to choose. You have to feel. But if you love your life, you will be able to find. If you don't love your life and you love something else, then there is a problem. You love money and you want to be creative. You cannot become creative. The the very ambition for money is going to destroy your creativity. If you want fame, then forget about creativity. Fame comes easier if you are destructive. Fame comes easier to an Adolf Hitler. Fame comes easier to a Henry Ford. Fame is easier if you are competitive, violently competitive. If you can kill and destroy people, fame comes easier. The whole history is the history of murderers. If you become a murderer, fame will be very easy. You can become a prime minister, you can become a president, but these are all masks. Behind them you will find very violent people, terribly violent people hiding, smiling. Those smiles are political, diplomatic. If the mask slips, you will always see Genghis Khan, Timur Lung, Nadir Shah, Napoleon, Alexander, Hitler hiding behind. If you want fame, don't talk about creativity. I'm not saying that fame never comes to a creative person, but very rarely it comes. Very rarely. It is more like an accident. And it takes much time. Almost always it happens that by the time fame comes to a creative person, he is gone. It is always posthumous. It is very delayed. Jesus was not famous in his day. If there was no Bible, there would have been no record of him. The record belongs to his four disciples. Nobody else has ever mentioned him, that he existed or not. He was not famous. He was not successful. Can you think of a greater failure than Jesus? But by and by, he became more and more significant. By and by, people recognized. It takes time. Greater a person is, more time it takes for people to recognize him. Because when a great person is born, there are no criterions to judge him. There are no maps to find him. He has to create his own values. By the time he has created the values, he is gone. It takes thousands of years for a creative person to be recognized, and then too it is not certain. There have been many creative people who have never been recognized. It is accidental for a creative person to be successful. For an uncreative, destructive person, it is more certain. So if you are seeking something else in the name of creativity, then drop the idea of being creative. At least consciously, deliberately, do whatsoever you want to do. Never hide behind masks. If you really want to be creative, then there is no question of money, success, prestige, respectability. Then you enjoy your activity. Then each act has intrinsic value. You dance because you like dancing. You dance because you delight in it. If somebody appreciates, good. You feel grateful. If nobody appreciates, it is none of your business to be worried about it. You danced, you enjoyed, you are already fulfilled. But this belief of being uncreative can be dangerous. Drop it. Nobody is uncreative, not even trees, not even rocks. People who have known trees and loved trees know that each tree creates its own space. Each rock creates its own space. It is like nobody else's space. If you become sensitive, if you become capable of understanding through empathy, you will be tremendously benefited. You will see each tree is creative in its own way. No other tree is like that. Each tree is unique. Each tree has individuality. Each rock has individuality. Trees are not just trees, they are people. Rocks are not just rocks, they are people. Go and sit by the side of a rock. Watch it lovingly. Touch it lovingly. Feel it lovingly. It is said about Zen Master that he was able to pull very big rocks, remove very big rocks, and he was a very fragile man. It was almost impossible looking at his physiology. A stronger man, very much strong than him, were unable to pull those rocks, and he will pull simply very easily. He was asked, "What is his trick?" He said, "There is no trick. I love the rock, so the rock helps." First I say to her, "Now my prestige is in your hands, and these people have come to watch, now help me, cooperate with me." And then I simply hold the rock lovingly and wait for the hint. When the rock gives me the hint, it is a shudder. My whole spine starts vibrating. When the rock gives me the hint that she is ready, then I move. You move against the rock, that's why so much energy is needed. I move with the rock. I flow with the rock. In fact, it is wrong to say that I remove it. I am simply there. The rock removes itself. A great Zen master was asked that whenever he makes tables, chairs, he was a carpenter, somehow they have some ineffable quality in them, a tremendous magnetism. How you make them? He said, "I don't make them. I simply go to the forest." The basic thing is to inquire into the forest from trees, which tree is ready to become a chair. Now these things look absurd because we don't know, because we don't know the language. For 3 days he will remain in the forest. He will sit under one tree and under another tree, and he will talk to trees, and he was a madman. But a tree is to be judged by its fruit, and this master has also to be judged by his creation. Few of his chairs have still survived in China. They still carry a magnetism. Just you will be simply attracted. You will not know what is pulling you. After 1,000 years, something tremendously beautiful. He said, "I go and I inquire that I am in search of a tree who wants to become a chair. I ask the trees if they are willing, not only willing, cooperating with me, ready to go with me, only then. Sometimes it happens no tree is ready to become a chair, I come empty-handed." It happened the Emperor of China asked him to make for him a stand for his books. And he went. And after 3 days he said, "Wait, no tree is ready to come to the palace." After 3 months the emperor again inquired. He said, "I have been continuously going. I am persuading, wait. One tree seems to be leaning a little bit." Then he persuaded one tree. He says the whole art is there. When the tree comes on its own accord, then she simply is asking the help of the carpenter. You can go and ask Asis. He has a feel for wood, and wood also has a feel for him. If you are loving, you will see that the whole existence has individuality. Don't pull and push things. Watch, communicate, take their help, and much energy will be preserved. Even trees are creative, rocks are creative. You are man, the very culmination of this existence. You are at the top. You are conscious. Never think with wrong beliefs and never be attached with wrong beliefs that you are uncreative. Maybe your father said to you that you are uncreative. Your colleague said to you, you are uncreative. Maybe you were searching in wrong directions, in directions in which you are not creative. But there must be a direction in which you are creative. Seek and search and remain available and go on groping unless you find it. Each man comes into this world with a specific destiny. He has something to fulfill. Some message has to be delivered. Some work has to be completed. You are not here accidentally. You are here meaningfully. There is a purpose behind you. The whole intends to do something through you. The second question, it is from Haris. A white and a small ara is visible just over your head. Why not a colored one is visible? It is a colored one. But all the colors are there. Hence it looks white. White is not colorless. White is the presence of all the colors together. White is the most colorful thing in the world. Hence it looks white. When a white ray passes through a spectrum, it divides into 7 colors. That's how a rainbow is created in the rainy season. Small particles of water hanging in the air function as spectrums. White rays of sun enter through those hanging particles of water and are divided into 7 colors. If you mix all the 7 colors in right proportion, you will create white. White is all colors together. I am not a Buddhist, I am not a Hindu, I am not a Christian, I am not a Jain, I am not a Mohammedan, and I am all. all colors together. Hence white is created. White aura is the greatest possibility. People have different auras. Somebody has a black aura. Black is the lowest possibility. Black is the absence of all colors. Hence in all the mythologies we paint a devil as black. That is the aura. We paint devil as black. Even Negroes paint devil as black. They should paint devil as white, but they paint devil as black. Black means absence of all colors, absence of everything. Black is negative. Black is just nihilistic. Black means simply negativity. Black is death. That's why death is also painted black. And when you mourn for a person, you use black dresses. White is the opposite polarity of black. Black is absence of all colors, white is presence of all colors. White is invisible rainbow. Go on watching your own face in the mirror. Next time you stand before your mirror, don't be bothered too much with your physiological shape. Try to see the aura. In the beginning it will not be visible, but if you go on working within 3 months, you will be able to see a subtle aura surrounding your face in the mirror, and that will be greatly indicative and helpful for your growth, because it will show the color where you are. If it is black, then much has to be done. If it is gray, then you are just in the middle of your growth. Half the journey is over. Half has yet to be traveled. You ask, why not a colored one is visible? Because there are all colors. It cannot be a colored one. A colored one means simply one color. And you will be surprised if you ask the physicists who know colors well what it is. You will be surprised. If you are using a red dress, that simply means the red color is reflected back, is given back to the world. Your dress absorbs all other colors, only the red color it doesn't absorb and reflects back. Shares with the existence back, it gives it back. It renounces red, that's why it is red. This seems paradoxical. Red dress is not red. It renounces red, that's why it looks red. Because people looking at you see it red because the red ray is going back and falls on their eyes and they see it as red. A black dress absorbs all. It doesn't give back anything. It simply absorbs all. The black is miserly. It doesn't share. It is a sort of spiritual constipation. It simply takes in and never gives out. White simply reflects everything back, gives everything back. Hence in India, white became the color of renunciation. White means nothing is absorbed. All the rays are returned back to the existence with thanks, with gratitude. When all the rays fall on your eyes, it looks white. When one ray falls in your eye, red, blue, green, then it is colorful. White aura is the best aura. And I would like to tell to Harish, he is a very sensitive man, a new sannyasin in a way, but a very ancient one in another. I have known him before, and he also knows this. May not be very conscious about it, but he feels somewhere. He is a very sensitive man, infinitely sensitive man. That's why he has been able to see the aura. If he tries a little, soon he will be able to see his own aura. And if he tries a little more, he can become an aura expert. He can see anybody's aura. And it is going to be helpful in his work. He is a psychotherapist. It will be of tremendous help to him. In the East, masters have used it as a psychoanalytic device. When a person comes to a master, the master tries, the first thing to see is his aura, because that will decide everything. He starts analyzing his aura, because that is very indicative. That shows about his deepest layers of mind, conscious and unconscious both. There are people sometimes who come to me who say they don't want to take sannyas, and in their aura I see that they are ready. Just the other day, Prasthan's ex-wife was there. I see she is ready. But she says she has to think about it. Her aura is crystal clear. She is finished with the world, but is unconscious about it. I told her that for me you have become a sannyasin. You can take for yourself a little time to think. There are people who want to become sannyasis, and even I initiate them, but I see their aura is still too much involved in the world, too much of the world. I hope for them. Their desire is good, but their preparation is none. People are not aware of their auras, otherwise they will be able to self-analyze themselves. Harish can attain to this capacity very easily. The third question. When Sri Aurobindo said that India is the spiritual center of the world, the thinkers all over the West felt offended. They mocked and laughed at it. Please comment. Sri Aurobindo was never really a very spiritual man. Originally, he was a politician, and politics lingered and lingered to the very end. He became religious, he tried hard, but the shadow of politics continued. His assertions should not be given too much value. He was a little chauvinistic about India. A as people are all over the world. An Indian thinks that he is the very center of the world, spiritually, very highly evolved, all rubbish. Nobody as a country is spiritually evolved. Nobody as a race spiritually is evolved. Spirituality happens only to individuals, not to countries. Yes, Buddha was evolved, so was Jesus. Mahavir was evolved, so was Muhammad. Krishna was evolved, so was Zarathustra. So what? Individuals. Just because Buddha happened to be born in India, India does not become spiritual. Because spiritual people have been born all over the world, to every part, to every country, to every century, to every race. But there is a spiritual egoism, and there are reasons also. India feels very inferior in many ways. It has to compensate. The West is very materially progressive, materially affluent, rich, rich in science, rich in living, rich in every way. India feels inferior. How to compensate it? This becomes a compensation that we are spiritually evolved. No country is spiritually evolved. Because spirituality is basically individual. It has nothing to do with country and climate. It is not confined to the boundaries of politics. Ask the Indians, now what about Pakistan? Just 20 years before, it was India. Then it was spiritually evolved. Now it is the worst country in the world. Ask an Indian. It was India just 20 years before, now it is no more India. Political boundaries. The world is one, the earth is one for a spiritual man. So if Aurobindo is talking about the geographical India, he is talking nonsense. But Indians feel good. They have nothing else to claim. Spirituality is good because it is a very invisible thing. You cannot disprove it. If somebody says, I am very rich, you can prove or disprove. You can go and see the bank balance, and somebody says, I am spiritual. Now what to do? How to prove or how to disprove? I have heard an anecdote. Few Christian theologians have concluded that Adam and Eve were Indians. Why? First, they argue, they had nothing to wear. Second, they stole apples. And third, with it all, they thought they were living in the Garden of Eden. They had nothing to wear, were stealing apples, and still thinking that they live in paradise. That's what an Indian goes on thinking. So when somebody like Sri Aurobindo declares that India is the center, the spiritual guide, the spiritual guru of the whole world, Indians feel very good. It enhances their ego. It helps them to stand a little more erect. It helps them to feel a little good. It cheers them, that's all. But it is not a truth. And Sri Aurobindo definitely was talking about the geographical India, because he was very fanatic, chauvinistic. He had the idea that Indians are very superior. They have a spiritual work to do in the world. No, but in another way, if you take India not as a geographical thing, not a political map, but if you take India as an eternal search for truth, then this country has been in search longer than any other country. It has sacrificed much for its search. That's how it has become so poor. Because when people start thinking of the inner world, they start dropping from the outside world. They become dropouts. India has been approaching to the inner continuously. If you take India as a symbol of inner search, good. But you should remember, then it is an inner search and a symbol of inner search. Then somebody who is born in the West and is seeking God is an Indian. And somebody who is born in India and is seeking money is an American. Then there is no trouble. Then Jesus is Indian, Zarathustra is Indian, Lao Tzu is Indian, Chuang Tzu is Indian, Bokoju, Rinchai, all are Indians. Then India has a totally different meaning. I also say that India is significant, but just as a psychological symbol. Longest India has been searching, and more Buddhas have happened here. The very climate, the milieu of spirituality helps. Jesus is rare. Zarathustra is rare. In India, Buddha, Mahavir, Krishna, Ram, it seems almost a normal state of affairs. But it is just as somebody says that West is symbolic for science. Yes, West has been searching scientifically longest. From the ancient Greeks up to today, the Western mind has been searching in scientific categories. It has been leaning more and more towards logic, mathematics, experimentation. And in the East, India has been leaning more and more illogically, irrationally, towards the inner. If you can think West as a symbol of science, then East can become a symbol for spirituality. If you think Greek mind as logical, then you can think Indian mind as religious. But then these are symbols, nothing to brag about. But every country, every race goes on bragging about itself. I have heard an anecdote. The mother superior of a convent was interviewing the three girls graduating from the high school. We, Margaret, she asked the first, and what will you be doing when you leave us? Ah, mother, The girl replied, I am not going to be leaving you. I am going to stay here and take the veil. Bless you, Margaret, said the nun, well pleased. Turning to the next one, she asked, and you, Catherine, what are your plans? Ah, replied Catherine, I am going to continue to get a good Catholic education and then teach little children in a parochial school. Most commendable, said the nun. And what will you do, Eileen? She asked of the third student. Lowering her eyes, the girl replies, I am going to become a prostitute. A what? Said the mother superior. A prostitute, the girl repeated, whereupon the nun fainted to the floor. They quickly revived her, but even before she rose from the floor, the nun gasped, Eileen, say that again. Mother, the girl replied firmly, I am going to be a prostitute. Ah, saints preserve us, said the nun, crossing herself quickly. I thought you said a Protestant. Every religion, every country, every sect is fanatically mad. Just they are the right. They are the true ones. They are on the right track and everybody is wrong. Everybody else is condemned. So, it is natural that the thinkers all over the West felt offended. But to feel offended is to be ill with the same disease. They mocked and laughed at it. There is no need to mock and laugh. Sri Aurobindo's statement is absurd. But there is no need to mock and laugh at it. Because when you mock and laugh at it, then you are carrying the same mind within you. Then an American feels offended because India, the guru. Then an Englishman feels offended. How can an Englishman ever think India as the guru? Impossible. But this is the same mind. One extreme is declaring that India is the center, the supremest guru of the world. And then the other is feeling offended. No need to feel offended. Just feel pity for such statements. Just feel sorry that still in this 20th century there are people who don't belong to this century. Very traditional, orthodox, not contemporaries at all. But there is no need to feel offended because it is ego assessing and it is ego feeling offended. So just see the point, don't feel offended. Otherwise, you are in the same boat. The fifth question, you refer to God always as him or he. What are some of the female qualities of God? Now, it is a very delicate problem. In fact, all his qualities are feminine. That's why I call him he and him. Otherwise, he has nothing else to call himself a male. You can feel sorry for him. And you can allow this much, can't you? He has all the qualities of a woman. But to call him she will be too much. just to compensate. I call him he and him. God is more a mother than a father. God is more like a womb than anything else. Out of God we are born, and back into God we dissolve. He is our birth and He is our death. He is like the ocean. He waves us, we become His waves. He absorbs us, we disappear. He is compassion, love. All His qualities are feminine. So there is no need to be worried about it. Why I call Him He? To call Him She would be too realistic. This much romance, this much poetry, you can allow me to call Him He. That balances. In fact, He is neither. He cannot be. Because man is born out of Him, woman is born out of Him. Either He is both, or He is neither. Because He is all. But I understand the question. It must be coming from some woman belonging to the lib movement. They have already started calling Him C. Nothing wrong in it. In fact, it may become by and by more prevalent. The word C is beautiful. In a way, it includes He. S-H-E. He does not include C, right? But C includes He. It is a better word. But very confusing. The whole humanity in all the ages has called Him, Him, He. Maybe something of male mind is involved in it, because it is man who has created all the scriptures. It would have been very offensive for man to think that he is a sea, God is a woman. It will not have been good for the male ego. Now, there is no need to move to the other extreme. What I am pointing at again and again is that extremes are not good. Up to now we have called Him He. Maybe male chauvinistic attitudes are implied in it. Now we can start calling C. Then woman chauvinistic attitudes will become implied in it. In India, we have a neutral gender, neither masculine nor feminine. Neutral. Brahma, the word for God in India, is a neuter gender word. We call Him it. That seems to be the best and the most scientific. We call Him that. Neither He nor She. Tattvamasi Svetketu. That art thou. That art thou, Svetketu. This is more scientific. From he, it is very easy for the pendulum to swing to see. But it will be again the same fallacy. God is both or neither. The sixth question: how can I know that a woman has fallen in love in reality, not playing games? This is difficult. Nobody has ever been to know, has been ever been able to know it. Because, in fact, love is a game. That is its reality. So if you are waiting and watching and thinking and analyzing whether this woman who is in love with you is just playing a game or is in reality in love, you will never be able to love any woman, because love is a game, the supreme most game. There is no need to ask for it being real. Play the game. That's its reality. And if you are too much of a seeker for reality, then love is not for you. It is a dream. It is a fantasy. It is a fiction. It is a romance. It is a poetry. If you are too much of a seeker for reality, obsessed with reality, then love is not for you. Then meditate. And I know the questioner is not that type. It is from Krishna Gautam. No meditation is possible, at least in this life. He has many karmas to fulfill with women. So he continuously thinks about meditation and continuously goes on moving with this woman or that. Now the women he moves with, they also come to me and they say, is he really in love with us? What to do? And here comes he with a question. But this problem comes to everybody sometime or other. Because there is no way to judge. We are such strangers. We are strangers. And our meeting is just accidental. Just on the road suddenly, we have come across, not knowing who we are, not knowing who the other is. Two strangers meeting on a road, feeling alone, hold each other's hands and think they are in love. They are in need of the other, certainly. But how to be certain that there is love? I was reading a beautiful joke. Listen it carefully. A woman arrived at a small Midwestern town late at night, only to find there was a single hotel room available. There was not a single hotel room available. "I'm sorry," said the desk clerk, "but the last room we had was just taken by an Italian." "What number is it?" said the woman in desperation. "Maybe I can work something out with him." The clerk told her the room, and the woman went up and knocked on the door. The Italian let her in. "Look, mister," she said, "I don't know you, and you don't know me. But I need some place to sleep desperately. I won't be any bother, I promise. If you just let me use that little coach over there." The Italian thought for a minute and then said, "Okay." The woman curled up on the coach, and the Italian went back to bed, but the coach was very uncomfortable. And after a few minutes, the woman tiptoed over to the bed and tapped the Italian's arm. "Look, mister," she said, "I don't know you and you don't know me. But that coach is impossible to sleep on. Could I just sleep here at the edge of the bed? Okay, said the Italian, use the edge of the bed. The woman lay down on the bed, but after a few minutes she felt very cold. Again she tapped the Italian. Look, mister, she said, I don't know you, and you don't know me. But it is very cold out here. Could I just get under the cover with you? Okay, said the Italian, get under the cover. The woman snuggled under, but the closeness of a male body stirred her and she started to feel a little horny. Again she tapped the Italian. Look, mister, she said, I don't know you and you don't know me, but how about having a little party? Exasperated, the Italian bolted up in the bed. Look, lady, he hollered, I don't know you and you don't know me. In the middle of the night, who we gonna invite to a party? But this is how it goes. You don't know me, I don't know you. It is just accidental. Needs are there. People feel lonely. They need somebody to fill their loneliness. They call it love. They sow love because that is the only way to hook the other. The other also calls it love because that is the only way to hook you. But who knows whether there is love or not? In fact, love is just a game. Yes, there is a possibility of a real love, but that happens only when you don't need anybody. That's the difficulty. It is on the same lines as banks function. If you go to a bank and you need money, they will not give you. If you don't need money, you have enough, they will come to you and they will always be ready to give you. When you don't need, they are ready to give you. When you need, they are not ready to give you. When you don't need a person at all, when you are totally sufficient unto yourself, when you can be alone and tremendously happy and ecstatic, then love is possible. But then too you cannot be certain whether the other's love is real or not. You can be certain about only one thing: your love is real. How can you be certain about the other? But then there is no need. This continuous anxiety whether the other's love is real or not simply shows one thing, that your love is not real. Otherwise, who bothers? Why be worried about it? Enjoy while it lasts. Be together while you can be together. It is a fiction, but you need fiction. Nietzsche used to say that man is such that he cannot live without lies. He cannot live with truth. Truth will be too much to tolerate, to bear. You need lies. Lies, in a subtle way, lubricate your system. They are lubricants. When you see a woman, you say, how beautiful. I have never come across such a beautiful person. These are just lubricating lies. You know it. You have said the same thing to other women before. And you know you will say the same thing again to other women in the future. And the woman also says that you are the only person that has ever attracted me. These are lies. Behind these lies, there is nothing but need. You want the woman to be with you, to fill your inner hole. You want to stuff that inner emptiness with her presence. She also wants. You both are trying to use each other as a means. That's why lovers, so-called lovers, are always in conflict, because nobody wants to be used. Because when you use a person, the person becomes a thing. You have reduced him to a commodity. And every woman feels, after making love to a man, a little sad, deceived, cheated. Because the man turns over and goes to sleep. Finished is finished. Many women have told me that they cry and weep after the man, their man has made love to them. Because after love, he is no more interested. His interest was only for a particular need. And then he turns over and goes to sleep. And he is not even bothered what has happened to the woman. And men also feel being cheated. They by and by start suspecting that the woman loves them for something else, for money, power, security. The interest may be economical, but it is not love. But this is true. This is how it can be. This is how it can only be. The way you are, living almost asleep, moving in a stupor, somnambulistic, this is the only way it is possible. But don't be worried about it, whether the woman loves you really or not. While you are asleep, you will need somebody's love. Even if it is false, you will need it. Enjoy it. Don't create anxiety. And try to become more and more awake. One day when you are really awake, you will be able to love. But then you will be certain about your love only. But that's enough. Who bothers? Because right now, you want to use others. When you are really blissful on your own, you don't want to use anybody. You simply want to share. You have so much is overflowing. You would want somebody to share. And you will feel thankful that somebody was ready to receive. Finished. That is the full point. Right now you are too much worried whether the other loves you really, because you are not certain about your own love. One thing, you are not certain about your worth. You cannot believe that somebody can really love you. You don't see anything in yourself. You cannot love yourself. How somebody else can love you? It seems unreal. It seems impossible. Do you love yourself? You have not even asked the question. People hate themselves. People condemn themselves. They go on condemning. They go on thinking that they are rotten. How the other can love you? Such a rotten person. No, nobody can love you really. The other must be befooling, cheating. There must be some other reason. She must be after something else. He must be after something else. I have heard a dirty, smelly, filthy-looking old Jewish bum sat down on a park bench next to a sweet young girl. The girl took one look at the bum and looked away in revulsion. Pretty soon she heard a noise and turned her head to see what was happening. She watched in horror as the Jewish bum took a sandwich from a brown bag and took a big bite of it. The meat was rancid, the lettuce was brown, and the bread moldy. Sensing the girl's eyes on him, the Jewish bum turned toward her and said, "Pardon me, miss, Would you like a bite of my sandwich? I suppose to make love would be out of the question. This is what goes on happening. You know about yourself. Love seems to be out of the question. You know your rottenness, worthlessness. Love seems out of question. And when some woman comes and says she adores you, you cannot trust. When you go to a woman and you say you adore her and she hates herself, how can she believe you? It is self-hatred that is creating the anxiety. There is no way to be certain about the other. First be certain about yourself. And a person who is certain about himself is certain about the whole world. A certainty achieved at your innermost core becomes a certainty about everything that you do and everything that happens to you. Settled, centered, grounded in yourself, you never worry about such things. You accept. If somebody loves you, you accept because you love yourself. You are happy with yourself. Somebody else is happy. Good. It does not get in your head. It does not make you madly egoistic. You simply enjoy yourself. Somebody else also finds you enjoyable. Good. While it lasts, live the fiction as beautifully as possible. It will not last forever. That too creates a problem. When love is finished, you start thinking it was false. That's why it has come to an end. No, not necessarily. Not necessarily. It may have had some glimmer of truth in it, but you both were unable to keep and hold that truth. You killed it. It was there. You murdered it. You were not capable of love. You needed love, but you were not capable of it. So you met a woman or a man. Things go very good, very smooth, fantastically beautiful in the beginning. The moment you have settled, things start getting sore, bitter. The more you have settled, the more conflict arises. That kills love. As I see, every love in the beginning has a ray of light in it. But the lovers destroy that. They jump on that ray of light with all their darknesses within. Dark continents, great Africas within. They jump on it and they destroy it. When it is destroyed, they think it was false. They have killed it. It was not false, they are false. The ray was real, true. So don't be worried about the other. Don't be worried whether the love is real or not. While it is there, enjoy it. Even if it is a dream, good to dream about it. And become more and more alert and aware, so sleep is dropped. When you are aware, a totally different kind of love will arise in your heart, which is absolutely true, which is part of eternity. But that is not a need, it is a luxury. And you have it so much that you hanker for somebody to share it, just like clouds when they are so full of rainwater. They would like to shower anywhere upon anybody and they don't bother whether it is a hilly track they are showering on, whether it is rocky they are showering on, or whether it is fertile soil thirsty for them. They don't bother. They go on raining on rocks, on fertile soil, on everybody, good and bad, thirsty, non-thirsty, needed, not needed. Because it is not a question now whether you need, it is a question now they are so full, they have to share. I love you, not because I need. I love you simply because what else can I do now? It is there. And I would like to shower it on you. And I go on showering unconditionally. It is not that you deserve it. Never think that. You know and I know that you don't deserve it. But that is not the point. What else can I do? I have heard a very old Tibetan story. There was a great sage who will not initiate anybody, who will not make anybody a disciple. And his fame spread far and wide, and thousands of people will come every year to his hilltop, and they will touch his feet, and they will cry and weep, and they will say, accept us. Initiate us into the truth you have achieved. Open the door to us also of your temple. We are thirsty. But he will say, you are not worthy. You don't deserve. First become worthy of me. And his conditions were such that nobody was ever able to fulfill them. Be truthful for 3 years, not a single lie. For 3 years, be celibate. Not even a thought of a woman or man. And so on and so forth. Those conditions were impossible. And those conditions are such that the more you try to make them, the more you will feel it is impossible. You can be a celibate if you don't bother too much about it. But if you think too much about celibacy, then you will be surrounded by many, many women in your mind. Many people had tried and nobody was successful, so nobody was initiated. Then the man was dying just 3 days before. Many people had gathered and he told his closest people that now you go and whosoever wants to be initiated, I will initiate. Only 3 days are left. The people knew him well and they said, what about your conditions? He said, forget all about those conditions. In fact, I was not ready to initiate anybody. Hence, I was insisting too much on the conditions. Now I am ready and I am full and I want to say, now forget all about the conditions. Whosoever wants to come, fetch them and be in a hurry because only 3 days are left. He initiated any and everybody whosoever came. People could not believe. They asked, what are you doing? We are sinners. He said, forget about it. I was not a saint up to now. That was the only trouble. I had nothing to initiate you to. There was no door. I was standing outside the door myself. But now the door has opened. Now I have to say, now there is no question of any conditions. It is not when you are aware, you are not in need of love. When you are not in need of love, you become capable of love. This is the paradox. When you are in need, you are not capable. And in this sleepy state, full of needs and desires, you go on stumbling. Why bother? Let me tell you one anecdote. Two very proper English gentlemen were drunk in the pubs looking for women. They finally got lucky and were about to bed with their respective finds. As they were lurching their way through the crowded London streets, one turned to the other and said, look here, old man. Do you mind switching bitches? No, I don't mind old thing, but can you tell a fellow why? Well, slobber the first, don't you know? Between the grog and the fog and the smog, I seem to have picked my old auntie. In darkness of desire, in madness of passion, between the grog and the fog and the smog, don't be too much worried whether the other's love is real or not. Right now, as you are, the real cannot happen to you. The real happens only to real persons. Gurdjieff used to say, don't seek reality, become real, because the real happens to real persons only. To unreal persons, only the unreal happens. The last question, how is it that I got such a wonderful opportunity to be at God's feet, and not just God, but such a beautiful God? It is Sila's question. You are also beautiful, Sila, and everybody is beautiful. It is just a question of realization. It is not only that God is beautiful. In fact, because God is beautiful, everything is beautiful. Because everything is out of God. Everything is in God. You may not know your beauty. You may not have looked into your own being. But let me remind you again and again, you are beautiful, Sila. Everybody is beautiful. In fact, there is no way of being otherwise. Only beauty exists, and only beauty can exist. Truth is beauty. Beauty is truth. Enough for today.